So we'll continue where we stopped. So let's go back. We are going to go, we are not going to focus on all Machshavet Yisrael. Machshavet Yisrael is a huge topic, right? What we are focusing on is on the thought of these people from starting the 16th century on, who have taken Kabbalah, what we know to be the esoteric teachings, and applied it to a language that people start using. And we're going to go and develop today what are we going to be focusing on, okay? And we'll try to, first tonight, I'll try to explain to you exactly what we're focusing on, and who are the people, and what's their special contribution. And throughout the generations, they created a school, and that school encompassed Hasidim, Misnagdim, Sfardim, and Ashkenazim. And this is what we're going to be focusing on, something called Machshavet Yisrael. And then we'll try to get the building blocks of such an idea. Okay? And we want to make it interactive. If you have a question, my name is Ari Bergman. If you have a question, if you disagree, please feel free to. There's nothing to be said. But so we spoke about like this. The esoteric teachings in the Jewish religion. There were two big schools. The school of Rabbi Shmuel and the school of Rabbi Akiva. The school of Rabbi Shmuel, their esoteric teachings were known to us. And they are actually meditational. They are not something that you could learn. You have to actually experience. And therefore, very few people participated in those schools. Those are called the literature of Echalot. They are called the palaces. Rabbi Shmuel was the one who is the Kohen Gadol. We spoke last week that there is an anachronism about Rabbi Shmuel, because Rabbi Shmuel is viewed, is portrayed as a Kohen Gadol, even though he lived after the Churban. How can you have a Kohen Gadol after the Churban? And we spoke about it, that the simple understanding is that in meditational terms, he was able to enter the Kodesh HaKodoshim, not in the real sense, but in the virtual sense, in a meditational, transcendental sense. That is one school, and that school comes from Nechunya ben Akana. And that's one school. Because we know that the Gemara alludes to esoteric teachings. Where does the Gemara allude to such a thing? The Gemara in Chagiga. There is such a thing called Ma'aseh Bereishis and such a thing called Ma'aseh Merkava. And there's a big discussion among the Rishonim to say what is Ma'aseh Bereishis or Ma'aseh Merkava. But the tradition was that Rabbi Akiva, the two schools that lived during, after the Churban, from the time of the Churban until from the year 71, give or take, to the year 135, which is the rebellion of Bar Kokhba, there were two schools, the school of Rabbi Akiva, the school of Rabbi Shmuel. And if anybody wants to ever do work, you realize that there are two different genres, two different schools. The school of Rabbi Shmuel, as scholars will tell you, are focused in the Midrash, not in the Mishnah. And Echalot is their esoteric literature. The school of Rabbi Akiva was focused on Mishnah. Rabbi Akiva was the one who created the concept of Mishnah that we have today. And he had Kabbalistic teachings. The Kabbalistic teachings that people knew about it was not through him, but through Rabbi Shim ben Yochai, his great Talmud. And that was a tradition. But the truth is, nothing was known about the work that they did up to the 14th century. So the Rabbi Kiva, they lived in the 2nd century for 1,200 years. People spoke about it. They knew there was some Kabbalistic teachings that came from the school of Rabbi Akiva. Now, the Gemara alludes that Rabbi Akiva had these Kabbalistic leanings, right? Meaning the Gemara in Menachah says Rabbi Akiva was able to darshan from the crowns of the letters. What do you darshan from the crowns of the letters? See, it must be something Kabbalistic, right? Yeah, because my kids say, anything that you don't understand, you say it's Kabbalistic. So if you understand how you darshan from crowns of the letters, Kabbalistic. What do you know? Until Rav Moshe de Leon came up and he said, listen, I have the ancient writings of the Midrash of Rabbi Shim ben Yochai, and that Midrash is called the Zohar. And this is the revelation of the Zohar. Now the Zohar, as you'll see, most Rishonim did not know that it existed. Because it was revealed in the time of the Rishonim. The first ones are Rabbeinu Bechaye.
How do we know that it really is?
So we're going to talk about it. This is what tonight we're going to dedicate a little bit. And I have something very interesting for you to see, and you could pass it on, but this is a very, very special book. I want to make sure that you treat it with respect, because this is a historical piece. The story of the challenge of the Zohar was first mentioned by a historian called the Sefer HaYochsin, the Avraham Zakut. Avraham Zakut lived in the 15th century. Avraham Zakut is known in Jewish canon because he was a historian and a scientist. He's the one who wrote the Perpetual Almanac. The Perpetual Almanac is the one who predicted all of the eclipses. And he is the he's the one who found the latitude. Avraham Zakut is credited. Anybody who knows the Lusiadas. The Lusiadas is a poem written for the discoverers, these people who came from Spain and Portugal to discover the Americas. They allude to a Jewish person who was the reason why Brazil, I'm Brazilian, if you didn't agree with my accent, I'm Brazilian. Brazil was discovered by the Portuguese, even though the conquistadores were Spanish, because by the expulsion, there was a Jew that was expelled and brought the technology to be able to get that. Who the technology came from Avraham Zakut. And Avraham Zakut is this person. Avraham Zakut is somebody who lived then, expelled, brought all the technology, so he was a scientist, very well respected, credited for the discovery of Brazil by the Spanish poets. They actually gave him credit to give to Jews, something very special. And he wrote a book of history. Again, Jews were not historians. The time when Jewish history was written was the 15th century. One of them is Avraham Zakut in Sefer HaYochsin. Sefer HaYochsin was so important that the Ramo, right, in the 16th century, the Ramo, who lived a very short life, he actually brought the Sefer HaYochsin to print for a second time. He edited and censored it. We're going to see the censorship that he did. And he wrote Hagoyes on him. So it's something very important. That it was important enough for the Ramo, who lived such a short life, to actually bring it to print and write Hagoyes. Now the Sefer HaYochsin is the one who brings the controversy of the Zohar. Because you could imagine, right? In the 14th century, somebody comes up with a book and says, this is an ancient book. And this is the Kabbalah of the Zohar. And people say, what? How do you know? What kind of test are we doing? And he quotes, now interestingly enough, he published it. The book was first printed in Constantinople, meaning Istanbul in Turkey. The second print was in Krakow by the Ramo. When the Ramo brought that to print, he actually took out the story and the controversy of the Zohar. Now, on this controversy of the Zohar, I have here the original Yochsin, the first fools, because this is a famous book. The one who was one of the first book critics of the Jewish people, of the Rabbonim, was who? Not more than the Yavetz. The Yavetz was a great book critic, and he wrote a book called Mitpachat HaSvarim, and he's the one who talks and deals about the authenticity and the authorship of the Zohar. And he writes on his Sefer that he heard that the first fools, the first print of the Yochsin brings the controversy. But he says, on the second print, I couldn't find it because the Ramo took it out. I thought that the Ramo took any allusions about Jesus and he took out the allusion about the Zohar. And he says, I'm going to find it. He sent it. And he writes in Mitpachat HaSvarim, he said, I sent somebody to get the book. And the guy, while he found the book, he actually stole the book from me and I had to fight. And he was a very feisty person. He says, I had to fight and I was able to get the book. And I got the book. It tells the story of the Zohar. And this is the book. And he says, I wrote on it Hagoyes. I wrote on it my notes. And this is, if you want to see, I'll pass it on. This is the original notes of the Yavetz on this. The Yavetz on the finding of the Zohar. And this is the original book that talks about the Zohar finding. And what he says, if you want to see the story, he says that the book was found by Moshe de Leon, and people did not know if it was real or not, and people were challenging. Can you imagine somebody comes up with a book? Everybody's challenged. So there was a great Kabbalist, the greatest Kabbalist at the time, Rabbi Yitzchok de Minako, Rabbi Yitzchok the Blind. He came to Spain to check the manuscript. And I'll tell you what he says, the story. Okay? Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Aliv, the Kabbalah, the Kramen, the Dat Mash, okay? ויאמר עליי דה באמת כי היה בידר מוישה נזכר ספר הזו אמיתי וסיבת אמיתו. So he says the people said that he did have the Zohar and the Zohar was an old copy that he had. And he says like this, I went there and I tried finding the Sefer, but when he got it, he was already dead, Rav Moshe de Leon. So I spoke to his wife and I said to his wife, where is the manuscript that I should check? And his wife told him that, listen, my husband didn't have a manuscript. Just made it up. He made it up because he needed some money, who knows? And that's what he did. And he took it. And so the Sefer says that Rabbi Yitzchok Dibinakwe decided to investigate the book because his wife is telling you that this is a made-up story. He investigated and Sefer HaYuchsin stops in the middle of the story. So it doesn't say what Rabbi Yitzchok Dibinakwe decided or not. So it becomes an open question. And this was the famous controversy of the Zohar. Now, the Yavetz writes that you see from the Sefer HaYuchsin that somewhere else he quotes Reb Shim ben Yochai as the author of the Zohar without any questions. So even though in the story of Reb Yitzchok Dibinakwe, this was the 14th century, by the 16th century it was accepted. And the Yavetz wrote a critique on the Zohar. And his issue of the Zohar is a couplefold. Number one, the topography of the Zohar matches Spain more than it matches Palestine. Right? The topography, if you look at the map and you try to find the places, you find in Spain, you're not going to find it. The Aramaic used by the Zohar is not an Aramaic that they spoke in the 2nd century. Probably constructed the Aramaic that they spoke in the 14th century, not the 2nd century. That's the second issue. And many things which the Zohar talks about are very strange. And one of the famous questions of the Yavetz, the Zohar asks, why is a shoe called Esh Noga? And the Zohar comes to explain that Esh Noga lo yisove, if there is a reason for the fire of the Noga. And the Yavetz says, where in all Chazal literature is the shul called Eshnoga? Is in Spanish it's called Esnoga. You're right, but to tell me that this is called Eshnoga and to ask a question and to write a whole sefer built on this, a whole shtickle, doesn't make sense. So these are the questions, and I'll tell you how we deal with it. But says the Yavetz, who asked the questions, he says it's clear from the Rishonim who lived at that time. Toises did not have the Zohar. Reb Kivegi in many places asks. Toises asks a question, brings a terutz, and Reb Kiva Eger says, it's a Zohar. Why doesn't Toises quote the Zohar? Because Toises did not have the Zohar. The Ramban didn't have the Zohar. But he says there is one first Rishon who quotes the Zohar, and he calls it the Midrash Shel Shim Ben Yochai. So he agrees that this is the Midrash Shel Shim Ben Yochai. Do you know who the first Rishon was? They quote it? Anybody? Huh? No, the Rambam didn't have. The Rambam at the time, the Rambam. In other words, you could say that maybe the Rambam has such traditions, but it didn't have the Zohar. The Zohar is only 14th century, right? Not the 11th century. So who is it? It's Rabbeinu Bechai. Rabbeinu Bechai Pasas Mishpotim quotes Zohar, and he says, I found in Midrashosh Rabbi Shim ben Yochai, in the Medrash of Rabbi Shim ben Yochai, the only Medrash of Rabbi Shim ben Yochai that we have is the Zohar. So says the Yavetz, who is he's the critic of the Zohar, he says it's clear that the Zohar comes from Shimon Yochai. The Rishonim agree to that. And probably because Rabbi Yitzchok Dibinakwe checked it, and he gave the authority. He certified it. He is the pedigree of the Zohar. Now the question is, what happened? First of all, what's the story of the wife? Was there a manuscript or wasn't there a manuscript? Why there's so many late ideas? Why is the topography late and why is the language late? Now I'll tell you what I think, and I spoke to Reb Shlomo Fischer on this, and I'll tell you how is something that I think is our tradition. The Kabbalists who agree to this, and the scholars who agree to this. And the answer is twofold. There is one sefer of the Zohar that the Yavetz writes, it's called the Raya Mehemna, it's called the Trustworthy Shepherd. It's part of the Zohar, it's called the Raya Mehemna, it's the sefer Achinuch, it explains the esoteric meaning of mitzvot. Interestingly enough, the Yavetz says it's so late that must be one of the latest parts of the Zohar because it was written, it's a 14th century work. And the Gro counted every letter of the Raya Mehemna, that every letter has a meaning. So how is it possible? So interestingly enough, the Karlin de Rebbe, and that's what Shlomo Fischer tells me, and the same thing, Wolfson, Elliot Wolfson will say the same thing, it was written through something called channeling. And channeling is called that the person who wrote it channeled in a mystical form Moshe Rabbeinu and Rabbi Shimon Yochai, and he wrote it. So it's something written, it's called in Hebrew Islapshus. It's Loshon Levisha Islapshus. So interestingly enough, the scholars will tell you that. And Rav Shlomo Fischer says that that is our tradition. He says a tradition from Karlin that this is how the Raya Mehemna was written. The rest of the Zohar, the Yavetz is at least our tradition. I think a lot of people will accept that the Zohar has a core of the Zohar, which is Reb Shimon Yochai, and that was transmitted in a secret school. And that secret school is the school of the Kabbalists. But it was transmitted orally. It was an oral work, like Kol Torah Shebal Peh. And like Kol Torah Shebal Peh, there is a core which is memorized literally. In other words, it's verbatim. It's called a verbatim memorization. And big parts of it are the interpretations that the Kabbalists gave from their traditions. By the way, I think, if anybody wants to see one day the book will be printed, this is how the Gemara is transmitted. So in other words, it's a dual voice. Part of it is verbatim transmission, and part of it is the interpretations that they got from the schools, and the Zohar is putting in writing these two together. The Chassam Sofer says the same thing. Chassam Sofer writes in the Droshos that the Zohar is composed of two parts. One part is the core of the Zohar, which the language and the words are verbatim from what they had the tradition from Shimon Yochai. And the rest are the interpretations that they got. They didn't make up the interpretations. Those are real interpretations that they transmitted in the secret schools from Rav to Talmud up to the 14th century, because the tradition was, and the Zohar writes in Parshas, this is in Parshas Noach, that the Zohar should be published. It should be not published. It should be revealed outside of the schools in the 14th century. That's why they did it. So it comes out that the Zohar is, the tradition is from all the Kabbalists, that this is Reb Shimon Yochai's schools. That's Reb Shimon Yochai's work. But it was transmitted by the Kabbalists, by those secret schools, up to the 14th century. Moshe de Leon was the one who had the tradition to reveal the book in the 14th century. And this is the tradition of Shimon Yochai, the tradition of the Zohar. So it comes out the Zohar for us, it is the school of Rabbi Akiva.
But we don't know clearly what Shimon Yochai wrote and what the
simple thing, nobody wrote anything. That's why at that time people look at the so they wanted to find originally when he came. The wife says there was no book. My husband was making it up. For sure, there's no book. The husband was making it up because those are oral traditions. Of the oral traditions, all the oral traditions are authentic, and the Kabbalists tell you they are authentic. But part of it is the core, and part of it is the explanations. Like the Gemara. If you ever see the Gemara has a part of the Gemara, which is in Hebrew, is attributed. You have a Moira who tells you what it says. And is very concise, and very precise, and very direct. And then you have in Aramaic an anonymous voice that asks, does it mean this? Does it mean that? What does it mean? It explains. It's the explanatory voice. That explanatory voice, which is the Stoma de Gemara, and the Zohar works the same way. So it's the traditions that were explained. So for sure, as the world was changing, they used different language, different terminology, different examples to explain the same thing. So the ideas are all authentic. The language of the explanation evolved over time. So authentic ideas and original ideas evolving over time. But the Kabbalists look at the Zohar as the work of esoteric Judaism, and different than Nechalot, is something which is analytical. It's something that can be learned, and it's a medrash on Parshas HaShavua. So the Zohar is written as a medrash, and is a circular medrash. The center and the core of the Zohar sits, you know, in each parsha. Where is the center of the Zohar, which all the Zohar flows around it? Is in Parshas Truma, because of the Kodesh HaKodoshim. And that core of the Zohar is called Safra Ditznivsa, the Book of Secrets. And all the Zohar is written around the Book of Secrets.
So what's the name?
Safra, the Book of Tznivsa, of hidden secrets, of hidden messages. The tradition, our Jewish tradition, is that those are real, the secret meaning of the Torah. Those are the two schools of the Kabbalistic thought that they were given. Okay, so this is the school of Rav Shimon Yochai. Let me tell you something. Yes.
Why did you choose to write it down?
Because as now, by the way, it's a great question. First of all, why is the Gemara written down? Why did they have to write? Now, it's always a question. When you write, the change of medium, when you change the writing, you make it independent of the school and you make it public, because now it's outside of the school. You lose control. The Zohar writes that in the 14th century, and it has Parshas Noach, it tells you that this is the time the God, the Malachim, allowed the Zohar to become public. And become public means losing control. How do you lose control? By writing it. I always tell you something. When the Gemara is written, okay, if everyone knows that, the Gemara is written. Okay, that's my impression, but I think that there is enough evidence. The Gemara is written in the 8th century. What happened in the 8th century when the Gemara is written? Automatically, there's a competing Talmud written at the same time. That's Adan. So in other words, once you write, you lose control. If it's oral, you're keeping the tradition, you are the ones teaching, you have the teachings, you can't do it. So that was written. That was the idea of publicizing the Zohar. It was public, but you should know something interesting. During the 14th century, the Zohar was not allowed. The Kabbalistic works, what was allowed to be published and what was not allowed to be printed, was a big issue. Because a lot of the Kabbalistic works were not allowed to be printed, and they were able to keep it outside of the written arena. Does anybody know a famous work, which is an amazing story of a Kabbalistic work that was kept outside of the canon? Is it about Avraham Abulafia? Did anybody hear about Avraham Abulafia? Avraham Abulafia was somebody who wrote in the times of the Rashba a Kabbalistic work, all written in circles. It's an amazing work because it's so... I told you, the Zohar is a circle, but it's not written in circles, it's written in parshas. But if anybody understands the Zohar is all evolving around... That's why, by the way, the Sfardim, right, the Shu is always around the Aron Kodesh. So he wrote the book in circles, and the Rashba writes on him that he was an Amoritz. And the Rashba goes out of his way to actually insult this Avraham Abulafia to no end. He says he was an Amoritz, he was an Apikoides, he doesn't know anything. And then Reb Chaim Vital, the Talmud of Dari, in Shari Ketusha, the fourth Shar, is the Shar of Ruach HaKodesh, he quotes Reb Avraham Abulafia extensively. The Chidor already writes, very funny, the Rashba tells Reb Avraham Abulafia is this Amoritz who knows nothing and he just decided to write Kabbalistic ideas in circles. And Reb Chaim Vital writes on him, on Shar Ketusha. The idea is, so says the Chidor, yes. The idea is that the tradition is that he was accepted. The Rashba wanted people not to use it. He thought that people were not ready. So the way to do it is saying, if you publish it, you are an Apikoides, you are Rosha. This guy is an Amoritz, don't touch the book. Not because he didn't believe in the book, but he didn't want people to use the book. And by the way, Reb Chaim Vital wrote Shar Ekdusha, Shar Dalet, which is Shar Ruach HaKodesh, which is an explanation of Avraham Abulafia, also was not printed. They actually took it out, and now the first time it was printed was in the 20th century by Rabbi Yaakov Hillel Yeshiva, And that was, they had also a tradition that you could start printing this stuff, because it becomes more public. Okay? So this is the tradition of the Zohar. That's why it becomes written. Now, in the 15th century, there is, so okay, this is this 14th century, 13th and 14th century. In the 15th century, this is the expulsion of the Jews. This is the new stage of the Zohar. First of all, the Zohar, everybody knows the 15th century, right? The end of the 15th century is the invention of the printing press. And books started being printed. So not only written, they started being printed, which becomes a mass publication. The Zohar was a big controversy if to print it or not, and it was printed. And the ones who printed it were the Christians. Because the Christians saw in the esoteric works a lot of things that they thought that matches to them. And we're going to learn what things they took and why did they take things to believe that they are theirs. But this is when the Zohar becomes public, because it becomes published in Mantua. It was printed. When printed, it becomes disseminated among people. And this is the generation that the Arizal in Tzfat, right? The Arizal in Tzfat for the 18 months, he opens up the Zohar, and all his interpretations of the Zohar take the Zohar to the new level. That's the school of the Arizal in the 15th century. In the 16th century. The Maharal of Prague, this is the first one who does, he takes these teachings, and he tells you that these teachings are already alluded in the Gemara, in the Agadah. And he goes and he crosses the work, and he says, you know something? There is already from the Geonim. The Geonim look at the Gemara, and they decided to create the Gemara into two parts. With the Gemara alludes to such a thing in several places, but the one who make a big issue out of it are the Geonim. That our Bavli is divided in two genre. One of them is called Halacha, and one of them is called Agadata. And on the Agadata, it looks like stories. It looks like folklore, to the extent that the word Agada, right? The word Agada, which Chazal call it Agada, in modern Hebrew, and even in the 16th century, they use the word Agada to mean what in Hebrew?
Fairy tales.
Legends. They give the word the legends of the Jews. And they said, they're legends, those are stories. The truth is, some of the Geonim says, don't pasken from Agadata, because Agadata is something, legends, to make people are falling asleep in Aloha, you tell them a story to make them up. And there was a very, very deliberate downgrading of Agada. The Maharal, this is the movement that starts with the Maharal in the 15th century. It tells you Agada is even higher than Aloha, because those are the esoteric teachings, and they were not taught clearly. They were taught in an obscure manner, but they're all in the Agada. You could see these esoteric teachings. But as long as the Zohar was hidden only for a school of Kabbalists, that you had to be a member of the club, Agada was a closed book. So the Geonim didn't want people to take Agada literally. So they said, okay, Agada, it's fairy tales. Well, Agada is like to basically make people, to encourage people or to give people some kind of meaning, but don't take it literally. Don't pass from Agada. So not because they were trying to downgrade Agada because they didn't see value, because they thought the Agada, the meaning was not to believe. When in the 16th century, and now you could understand why historically the 16th century, the Zohar is published and printed. They thought that the idea is to bring how the Zohar explains the Agada, that the Agada has a terrific, deep, and transcendental meaning. And this is the school that starts with the Maharal. And this is bringing Kabbalistic teachings into something which is part of the Gemara, which is part of the Agada, and that you can't learn Agada. The Maharal went, if anybody knows, there was somebody in his time called Rabbi Azariah de Minedumim, Rabbi Azariah Figo. He wrote a book called the Maor Enayim, The Light of the Eyes. And he was a frum person, but he takes the Agada and he says, okay, Agada, are folk stories, and they are not real, and it's based on faulty science, and it's based on all kinds of legends. And the Maharal went crazy with that. Because the Maharal comes to defend Agadah and tell you Agadah is all Kabbalistic teachings, but you need somebody to know Kabbalah to teach you what Agadah means. And that was the purpose of the Maharal. Yes.
So the people who explain, let's say like the Maharsha, whoever explains the Agadah before the times of the Maharal, is that based?
The Maharsha is the same time, give or the same time. It's okay. Also connecting the same ideas. Yes.
So that's based on Zohar, all
the esoteric teachings.
So there's
yes.
No Rishonim who explained it?
The Rashba explains it. And some people say that the Rashba did not know the Zohar because the Rashba told you the first one is Rabbeinu Bechaye, but he had Kabbalistic traditions. So people say that your Ramban quotes Kabbalistic ideas, but those are not the Kabbalistic ideas that we can relate to because the Zohar is a system that we're going to learn. It fits with everything. So this is the Marsho, is the Maharal, and afterwards it goes into a slew of people. This is the Shloa Kodesh, and then is the Ramah Mifano at the same time of the Beis Yosef, and then goes on to the Baal Shem, that the Baal Shem also felt that this thing has to be publicized, the Baal HaTanya. On the Hasidim you have Reb Tzodek, the Sfasemes. On the Ashkenazim was the Groh. The Groh, as much as we know about the Groh, and the Groh was great in every part of Torah, where the Groh really created a revolution is on the esoteric part of Torah. All his writings are on the esoteric part of Torah. He wrote a Pirush on Safra Ditznusa, on all the Zohar, on Tikkun Zohar. He wrote a Pirush on everything. And Reb Chaim Vital, Nefesh HaChaim, and the Leshem, and this school goes on and on and on. So Machshava, what we call, is exactly this. The esoteric teachings of Torah, as they connect to the learning that we have. So when you learn Agadata, to realize the deep meaning that it has. And I think that the way to learn Agadah is the only way is this. Because first of all, the Maharal goes into something. I just saw there's a letter from YU just came out. First of all, the Maharal says that you cannot take Agadah literally. And also, don't take Agadah as a historical account. Because some people take Agadah literally. That the Agadah is something that happened and they're telling you a story. The Maharal in several places, if you want to send to you, he says, don't ever do that. Because otherwise the stories make no sense. Look at the story of the Churban. Right? The Churban, according to Tur Malka, we had billions of people. When we know that Israel at that time, who knows, had like a million people, most. All the stories and all the Agadah has to be taken in a different meaning. It's not historical. It's not scientific fact. And this is something which is one of the foundational ideas of... Now, the Marsha, on the other aspect, anybody who knows the Marsha always explained allegorically the Agadot. But he says in several places that the Agadot are to be taken literally. They have deeper meanings, but they are literal cases. Rabbi Barbar Chana, when he goes visit and he sees these huge animals... It's all real stories. The Maharal will tell you that's not. They are all illusions. You cannot, if you look at Agadah without the teachings of those esoteric teachings, Agadot will make no sense. And they are not supposed to be literally. The one who takes the Ramchal takes even a step further. And here I have a Ramchal. The Ramchal is the one, he published the book. The Ramchal, we won't go into the story, but the Ramchal is this huge character, right? That he has two lives. The life in Padua and the life in Padua where he reveals all these Kabbalistic ideas. And then he was banned and he goes to Amsterdam. And in Amsterdam he devotes himself to the same school of the Maharal, which is hiding Kabbalah into the understanding of the Agadot. And he wrote a ma'amar called Ma'amar al Agadot. He wrote a ma'amar al Agadot. And he says on the writings, he says, on Chazal decided to write the Gemara. And they wrote the Gemara. they wrote the Gemara because they were afraid it to be forgotten, or however there were conditions. But on the Agadata, because it made no nafkimina la'alocha, they didn't write it. And they wrote cryptically. They wrote in a way which is very cryptic, to allow, to know, to, the people should know that you cannot take it literally. The Rabchal says you cannot take it literally. That they would have to look for a meaning, and the meaning would be in the Kabbalistic teachings, so it would be hidden. So they wrote in a way which is this cryptic way, to make sure that people don't take it literally, to search for the inner meaning of Kabbalah. That's it. So the Ramchal says that Agadata never made sense until it was opened up in the 16th century. 16th century is this explosion of Agada. And I think that this is what Machshav that will dedicate the Shira to. To understand the inner meanings according to this code that spans through everybody, to see the beauty and I think the depth and the understanding of what the Agadot mean. And this is a whole new genre. And that's the whole purpose of the class. Yes.
So, in the Zohar is the school of Rabbi Akiva. Whatever happened to the school of Rabbi Ishmael?
So, Rabbi Ishmael's school, I told you, his books were public. Because they make no sense. If anybody wants to study the books are fascinating. They are called Echalot. It's all meditational practices. But unless you go through a meditational, you cannot understand what it says. It's meditational. Rabbi Avraham Abulafia, who is the same school, also, he's so meditational that you have to, the book is written in circles and you have to move the book around for you able to read it because you go into a trance. So those things are available, but nobody can do it. There are few people who practices this stuff. Very few people practice it. But the beauty of the Zohar is learning, is a medrash. Those are ideas that you can understand, that they make sense. They're analytical, they're not experiential. Reb Tzadok writes in the Sefer HaZichronos something very interesting, because the Gemara says the Ma'ase Merkava, you cannot learn with anybody. You have to learn on your own. So Reb Tzadok says, how can you learn on your own if nobody teaches you? How are you going to find out? He says, because Ma'ase Merkava is this experiential Kabbalah. It's the Kabbalah that's done through meditation and transcendence. So once you go into meditation, you get revealed and etc. And this you're not allowed unless you have the authority. But to learn Kabbalah as part of Agadata, to understand and to have the teachings and the meanings of life, says Reb Tzadok, there's nothing wrong with it. It was kept secret for many years, but this is the avoda of this generation, and this is what will change everything. And the purpose of this show is this, because I'll tell you the truth. If you want to see what's the beauty of the Torah, is something called consilience. What, see, Rabbi Yoshe Be'er always held very much of a thinker, non-Jewish, called William James. Did anybody know what William James was?
The philosopher.
What was his philosophy of mysticism?
I don't know.
His philosophy of mysticism. He wrote, I forgot the name of his book, but William James wrote a book, and he says, you know what mysticism is? And if you look in every mystic tradition, you look in Islam, the Sufis, you look into the Christians, there is one thing that unites all mystical experiences. Does anybody know what it is? What define mystical ideas? And we're going to see, because this is the core of the learning, and you'll see, and that's what makes it so special and beautiful. Is the language of the One. The language of the One, the Oneness. Mystical ideas is the unity, how everything fits in, how everything is connected. So William James says all the mystical ideas are talking about the same thing, because it's all connected, that you see how everything fits in. And this is the language of the mystical people. What the Chiddush of Agadata is, that once you learn it, you see how halacha, how the Midrashim, how science, how history all fits in. It shows the beauty of the world, to show how Torah is truly the blueprint of the world, because everything fits in. Everything makes sense. And that's the beauty of the Zohar that really puts everything into perspective, is truly the language of the One. And I think that that's what makes, I think that this Machshava, what it does, is gives you a sense of the truth of Torah. Because the truth of Torah, I always tell you something. How do you know that something is true or something is not true? What is the definition of truth? So we know Karl Popper. Karl Popper, the famous philosopher, what does he say? Does anybody know what is the criterion of truth? It's something called falsifiability. All science is based on that. Falsifiability means something is only true if you tell somebody, okay, my idea is true because of A, B, and C. And if you prove that A, B, and C is wrong, I'm ready to give it up. If you can't put it to the test, it's religion, it's not science. By the way, the Supreme Court of America took Karl Popper as law. That, you know, there was a separation of law and religion. They wanted to know about creationism. Is creationism religion or science? Karl Popper to the test. Is it falsifiable? Right? So his vision of truth is falsifiable, which means that something is only temporary truth. Not something is true until proven wrong. It's amazing because Karl Popper himself, on his theory of falsifiability, they tried to falsify and it wasn't. He was always found the hates of how not to falsify it. So even his theory was not falsifiable. So how we know something is true? I think that something is true. The definition of truth, according to the Maharal, is look at the word emet. Aleph is the first letter of the alphabet. Mem is the middle letter of the alphabet. Tav is the last letter of the alphabet. When everything fits in, when there's a unity, everything is consistent, everything is beautiful, everything makes sense, that you don't have to find ad hoc hypothesis to start answering things, this is truth. Truth is experiential. Truth grows on you. The more you know, the more it fits in. Not the more you know, you find more holes. If you keep giving excuses, it's something which is not truth. Truth is that you can only appreciate the truth of Torah by learning, I think, what it's called, Machshava. Because otherwise, it's disjuncted. You have a word here and a word there, and the answer is Shivim Ponim HaTorah. And then you have gematria that make no sense, and then you have problems with history, and then you have to believe things that they might not be believable. And if you want to appreciate the truth of Torah, Machshava, at least for me, gives me that. And hopefully I will give you the teachings, and we're going to learn the building blocks that you should be able to learn, once you have the building blocks, to learn yourself the words of the Maharal. And you see how everybody's saying the same. The Maharal, and see, the Baal HaTanya based himself on the Maharal, the BP Sforim V'Sofim. He builds his Torah, the Baal HaTanya, on the Shlo and the Maharal. The Gro builds on the same things. So as much as the Gro and the Baal HaTanya, or Bali Machloikes, they are talking the same language and they are interchangeable. And they're the same ideas. That unity and that beauty and that, in English is called consilience. Consilience is how to see how everything works together, everything fits together, everything's part of a big system that works together. Okay? So it's 10 o'clock, we have to stop. But what I'm going to give you, we'll start, Mirtz Hashem, next week we'll start, not next week, in 2 weeks, Mirtz Hashem, we'll start learning the first steps. The first one I want to give you is a Maharal, which I have here the copies. I'm going to leave if anybody wants to take it. It's in Perek Lamed Aleph, and we're going to learn together this Maharal. Because this is one of the foundations. If the basis of Kabbalah is the unity, we are going to see how the world is the creation of a diversity within unity. And one of the basic foundations is how the Torah in the world that we live is a world which is binary. And all the world is a bunch of binary numbers, and all the Torah and everything that we have is these two sets. It's always binary. And these two realms, two cones, is something that works people in science, it works in Torah, it works in psychology. And today, the biggest Kahneman, I'm going to use the work, anybody who read Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, which is a work of Kahneman and Tversky, which was also binary, you'll see why, who wrote a book about human psychology, and he won the Nobel Prize in Economy, the only price, Nobel Prize of Economy, that was in economics, that was given to a psychologist, is built on these ideas. The ideas of Kabbalah that you see, which is the basic of all the works of the Maharal, which is this binary world that was created from the world of unity, which is the foundation of Torah, is the foundation of the universe, and is the foundation of Halacha. And this is what we're going to learn next, the 2 weeks. So 2 weeks will be the world of the binaries as written, and it's built. I decided to take one Maharal in Perek Lamed Aleph of Sefer HaTiferes that we'll learn together and to see how it works. Have a great week.
I always think that it's dangerous. I didn't learn when I grew up.